You're listening to Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. I feel like I should apologize for interrupting. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We're listening to Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic. This is Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique. WGBH has just launched the Bernstein Experience on classical.org. Talk about a good name for a website, which is celebrating Leonard Bernstein's centennial. Join us to talk more about it and his legacy are his daughters, Nina Bernstein Simmons and Jamie Bernstein. It's great to meet you both. Thanks so much for being here.
Hello.
How are you both?
Great to have you here.
And longtime friends of Corby Cummer. Talk about universes
yes.
connecting.
I just about fell down with amazement.
So
to
did
into
he.
Him.
Well,
so
you got, everyone has very good taste. Let's put it that way. So before we get to the Bernstein Experience, just for people who don't know, your dad had very deep Boston roots.
Oh, yeah. He was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, a stone's throw away.
Mm-hmm. And also Boston Latin School?
Boston Latin School.
To say nothing of Harvard.
To say nothing of Harvard. Mm-hmm. And his father, Sam, ran the Samuel Bernstein Hair Company, which had its offices on Boylston Street just here.
In Boston, it's Bernstein.
Was the slogan.
That's pretty good.
That's great. Okay, and also, of course, Tanglewood, and we're going to talk a lot about Tanglewood just coming up. So what the Bernstein Experience on classical.org, tell us what it is.
Well, it's this amazing amalgam of resources about our dad, and they are continuing daily to add more and more content. The classical.org will be an all-around website having to do with classical music, but the first year of classical.org is dedicated to our dad's centennial. So the whole first year is a celebration of Leonard Bernstein in every possible way.
There are exclusive pieces of content like I was just watching the other day this incredible video of him rehearsing the Tanglewood Fellows.
Yes.
Two months before he died.
2 months before he died.
Oh, my God.
It is amazing. And they're doing Copland Third, and they're tackling the second movement, which is tricky. And he's so full of love. Oh, my God. You can just see it pouring out of him.
Right. And so short of breath.
Well, I actually thought he was doing pretty well. He wasn't coughing the way I remember him coughing at that time.
The hunch in his shoulders, you could tell that it was just costing him to breathe.
But there was just so much love coming out of him. And even when he was saying to the violins, you know, that was so out of tune. He didn't say that. He said, "We're not going to discuss that, are we?"
Well, you know, what I thought was wonderful, too, I mean, many of us have seen pictures of your dad conducting, but you heard him talking to the... I think at the beginning comes out and says, "I feel like Job, I'm not feeling that great." And then he talks about having missed the previous day, and he's back and forth with the members of the orchestra. Leonard Bernstein talking and creating with the orchestra was really neat to listen to.
See, that's why that content is so priceless, because it does give you a window on his personality that you just can't find anywhere else. Even if you read all of his writings and you watched all of his programs, just to be with him in real time was such a treat. And that gives you a sense of that. Also on the site is there are excerpts from interviews he gave John Gruen, who was writing a book at the time. This was in 1967. John Gruen was writing something called The Private World of Leonard Bernstein, which was essentially a coffee table book, but there was extensive text as well. And he had hours and hours of interviews that we had not heard ever.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. You know,
Until now.
I feel I know a decent amount about your father, but I was not his son. You were his daughter, so it's a little bit different. What did you learn from that? By the way, if you haven't been there yet, not only 24/7, there is music your father either composed, conducted full-time is available.
Yeah.
There's a photograph of him in Sondheim the writing of
West Side Story
that is so intimate and so beautiful. What kinds of things, Nina, starting with you, what did you learn that you didn't know or hadn't heard about your father from classical.org? Were there such things?
Oh, my goodness. It's new to me still, so I have barely cracked the surface.
How about you, Jamie? Are there things that you didn't know, or at least first experiences with sound or visuals about your dad?
Well, there are so many things that are being flown at us all of a sudden. It is true about the John Gruen book with its accompanying photographs by Ken Hyman. Those tapes that we found, there are so many of them. And, you know, excerpts were in the book, so we certainly knew the excerpts. But we had never heard the entirety of the rest of the interviews. So they're kind of a revelation. We're still catching up on them.
Yeah,
you know, there's just too much content.
Interviews, I know one of your father's goals was to make classical music accessible to young people.
Oh, yeah.
And I hope this site is going to help. We can talk about this. I mentioned to you when I met you a few minutes ago that Marjorie and I were lucky enough working with Brian McCreath and Ron Delacaze and other people on opening night of the BSO. We'd interviewed a ton of people, and obviously it was an old Bernstein night, as you well know. Your brother was there, and we got to talk to him, too. We interviewed a lot of young people, like really young people. There was that, remember that woman who lived in Harvard? She lived in the same house at Harvard your father did, and she talked about, he had given a piano back to the house in subsequent years, and she talked so beautifully about touching the piano that your father had given to the residence hall and that sort of thing. But I was amazed, and maybe I shouldn't have been, how connected 20-somethings and late teenagers were to the work of your father. Are
that's
you surprised
great news.
By that?
No. It's great news for one, but
it
hardly surprising
Why
for another.
Why is it hardly surprising?
Because he is so easy to connect with. And certainly you see it from that clip, again, the Copland rehearsal, how easy he was with the students. And that was one of the things about Tanglewood that always got his motor running, was that he got to relive his experiences as a student.
He was in the first class.
The very first class in 1943. Yeah. And so whenever he would show up at Tanglewood, he would behave like a student again. And, you know, he just became one of them, no matter how old and ill he may have been. So he would go out after, you know, they'd have a fantastic performance of Sibelius, and then they'd all go have a party, and he'd stay and party with them as if it were 1943.
Well, that was one of the things your brother said to us when we got a chance to interview him, that he was up until 2, 3, and 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
You know,
that was his way. He didn't sleep very much. That's how he got so much done.
I guess so.
It's amazing how much you can get done when you never sleep.
We're talking to Nina and Jamie Bernstein, and WGBH had just launched the Bernstein Experience on classical.org, and it's in commemoration of Leonard Bernstein's centennial. So I just heard this this morning actually, Brian McCreath from WCRB, one of our colleagues, talking about West Side Story. I learned a lot in just a couple of minutes about West Side Story, that it was something about how we all know it was supposed to be, you know, the Montagues and the Capulets from Shakespeare, but there was some talk about it being Catholics and Jews before it wound up being...
Yeah, in the early iterations.
Yeah, before it wound up being Puerto Ricans and Americans, and apparently this was after, I'm not sure who read the story in the New York Times, but this gang war near Columbia over this park where 200 teens showed up to have a gang fight.
Yeah, this was in L.A.,
yeah.
That's where he and Arthur Lawrence found themselves by the pool at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and they were both reading the paper, and they had shelved the Romeo and Juliet concept. What are you fixing my mouth?
Oh, you know what it is? Pull this thing up.
Oh, sorry, everybody.
That's
perfect.
Okay.
That's perfect.
So they had shelved the Romeo and Juliet concept because it just wasn't working on the east side of Manhattan. And so Arthur and our dad found themselves by the pool, and they each had a copy of the L.A. Times, and there was a story about gang warfare in L.A., and there were Mexicans, and there were, you know, so-called white people on the other side, and they said, maybe...
The penny dropped.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the way. And the story goes that he shelved Candide for a minute so that he could write West Side Story, and resumed Candide.
Before we move on from this, with Catholics and the Jews and a gang war rally with a bunch of teenagers that we missed out on?
No, the first version was called East Side Story because it took place on the Lower East Side, and the concept was that The Romeo and Juliet characters would be, one would be from a Jewish family,
okay,
and the other
gotcha.
From a
okay.
Catholic family, and all the tensions would explode over the Easter and Passover holidays.
Oh, that could have been pretty good, too.
It could have been pretty good, but the music
but
doesn't quite have
that.
The spice.
No. I don't think so. We have a little sound from the West Side Story, don't we, Jim?
Do we? I don't know. I've been looking at the clip sheet. Do we, people
I thought
back
we did.
There?
We had something from
we'll sing it for you.
We'd yeah, like it. Lin-Manuel. We can all sing it.
From Hamilton,
I don't
his
know.
Favorite,
do we?
Maria from West Side Story? Yeah.
Maria, Maria, Maria. All the beautiful sounds of the world in a single word. Maria, 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 Maria,
Maria. I've just met a girl named
So what was it like growing up in that house?
Is that Larry Kurt?
I don't know. Who is that?
I think that was.
I don't know. Who is it? Do we know?
Is that the original cast album?
I don't know.
We'll
it's not José Carreras, that I can
us.
Tell you.
What was it like growing up in the house with this guy?
Oh, it was noisy.
What does that mean exactly?
It means that there were a lot of people around all the time, and everybody was always laughing and singing and carrying on.
Word games.
Yeah.
And staying up late.
And carousing.
Charades.
Were you the one of the sisters? I read a piece this morning where one of you, I think it was you, were doing your homework. And as you're doing your homework in your room, you're listening to classical music in the background. Mm-hmm. It is you. And your father walked in. What did he say to you?
He said, turn that off.
And why?
Aren't you distracted? And I said, I like having it on. It's very soothing. And he said, now you and I have to have a talk. Music is not about being soothing. Think about Beethoven and think about, you know, Ravel. And that, those are not soothing pieces all the time. You
active
have to
listening.
Active listening.
Listening. I love
you
that
can't,
expression.
If you're going to do your homework, do your homework. And then if you want to listen to music, turn it on and listen to the music.
Do you know, I even wonder advice. When people grow up with huge talents, whether they're actors or musicians or composers or whatever, do you have like a complex that you think, how come do I have to grow up when you're little? Do you think you have to grow up and you have to write the second West Side Story?
Or East Side Story in this case,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a burden.
Yeah.
And, you know, we get asked these questions often. And so I took it upon myself to write a book to answer in a long form some of these questions. So you can read my book in June. It's called Famous Father Girl.
Well,
tell us a little bit about it. Tell us a little bit.
Well, I had a second grade classmate who used to tease me by calling me Famous Father Girl. And at the time, I didn't really think about it that much. But it was later on that I became self-conscious about the idea that we were different because we had this father who was on television.
Yeah.
And that was what really made the impact for us as kids, was that he was on TV with the young people's concerts.
Well, you also wrote a great piece about the whole Black Panther cocktail party, and you have a great line in this. People may know Tom Wolfe wrote a Radical Chic was his piece you wrote about this. You have a great line about Tom Wolfe kind of sneaking into the party, silently ingesting all of it like a python gradually swallowing a rabbit hole. But you talked about being in high school and the problems this caused for you as a teenager. Tell people about that.
Well, it's complicated. When you want to just blend in with your friends and just be part of the gang, but you are inevitably being singled out for this reason that you have no control over. So on the one hand, you know, I was writing songs myself on the piano and the guitar, and I was kind of proud of what I was doing, and I liked the attention, but at the same time, I was so self-conscious and not really wishing to invite comparisons with the more illustrious music writer in the family.
Yeah.
So I was very conflicted and very push and pull about making music myself and about attracting attention to myself.
But you had the blowback from this because the Black Panthers were very controversial and your parents were trying to help them get bail. And then there were apparently protesters that turned out to be FBI plants.
That is correct.
Outside.
But we didn't know that at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, we didn't find that out until the Freedom of Information Act allowed our dad to look at his own FBI files.
Which was copious.
In the 1980s, 800 pages long.
You know, it was one of the most depressing moments of my life. When I was in law school, I did an FOIA for my own, and I had no file. It doesn't get worse than that. Humiliated amongst your friends,
I'm so sorry.
I'll tell you. It was
Nina,
really...
why did your father have an 800-page FBI file? Why were they looking at him?
Oh, he was a
lefty.
Card-carrying lefty, you know? What are you going to do? The guy lent his name to any number of causes.
Since the 1940s, they were following him.
30s.
Even the late 30s, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what else we should mention here? Some really sexy photos of your father. I mean, he was a very dashing...
What a looker.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable
looker. He had it all. Can we just say...
So did your mother. Your mother is a beautiful looking woman, too.
You know, beauty, brains, talent, the whole number.
I know, it's just not fair.
It's not fair.
Life is not fair.
And then here we are, like lumps.
We were not saying that. We want to be clear about that. We're talking to Nina and Jamie, who were Leonard Bernstein's daughters. Can we come back to Tanglewood for a second? When I was there for the first time this summer, and Marjorie had been there before, and we were taking, what was the house? The Saranac
House?
Bernadette Horgan, who does communications, and her husband were showing us around and showed us some of the pictures and the moments with the two pianos with your father. What did Tanglewood mean to Leonard Bernstein? You know?
It meant everything to him.
Because he started there? I mean, tell me why.
Well, I guess to be on the ground floor of something, of an institution that would take such deep root. And I guess he knew it even then at the very beginning that it was something very, very big and important and would last.
Yeah. Also, it was the place where he really came to understand that teaching and learning were one and the same activity for him, and that he loved the combination of the two. And his mentor, Serge Koussevitzky, his conducting mentor, started Tanglewood.
Of course.
That was where he began as a student and then almost immediately became a teacher, although he did become a teacher as a kid. The minute he learned one thing on the piano, he turned around and taught it to somebody else. He always had that circuitry of teaching and learning.
Yeah.
Well, the Young People's Concerts, that's what they were called,
Young People's Concerts,
that he was doing. That. So that was an obsession.
Do you know
with
that we derive that we descend from rabbis?
No, that is, I did not know that.
So
why do you bring that up?
I bring that up because even without knowing, we always knew that Daddy had a rabbinical streak.
Mm-hmm.
Because he wanted to be teaching you all the time.
You know,
and learning.
A while ago, I read your Uncle Burton's book about growing up, you know, growing up
Family
in the
Matters.
Family Matters. Yeah.
It was a terrific book. But he talked about the persistence of your father, too, from an early age in his career, right?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he really wanted to do this.
He really wanted to do this.
Not everybody was that enthused about it.
In
Boston, it's Bernstein, and Sam wanted our dad very much to follow in his footsteps.
Was the immigrant dream, after all. Sam had come all the way over from Russia, Ukraine, without a coin in his pocket, and had scrimped and saved and toiled and traveled all that distance.
And succeeded.
And succeeded and made a business. It was the immigrant dream come true. And he could pass his business on to his eldest son so that Leonard Bernstein could run the Samuel Bernstein Hair Company.
But that didn't happen. Tell us about his... He was a prodigy, basically, and was unbelievably talented. How did they reconcile that? When did Grandpa say okay?
So not till the big debut. You tell
in 1943 in November on the 14th, he had to step in for, as he's always referred to, the ailing Bruno Walter. I thought ailing was like an honorific, like the Reverend ailing Bruno Walter. So our dad stepped in and. It was nationally broadcast on the radio, and he became famous overnight. It was an absolute Cinderella story.
This is the New York Philharmonic?
New York Philharmonic.
On the radio.
New York Philharmonic, which is a very big deal.
And it was broadcast on the radio of a Sunday afternoon. The entire nation was listening, and it was such a big deal that this kid, 25-year-old American kid, without a rehearsal, had stepped up and had killed it. And we landed on the front page of the New York Times the next morning. Big, big deal. Right. So the reporter who approached Sam said, I understand that you were reluctant to encourage the young Leonard Bernstein.
Is it true you wouldn't pay for your son's piano lessons?
Right.
That was true, wasn't it?
Yes, it was true for a time.
Yeah.
And so Sam famously replied, well, how was I supposed to know he would turn out to be Leonard Bernstein?
That's great. Did it matter to your father to be famous? Did he care about being famous?
I think he liked it a lot. In the early days, he
liked
it a lot.
Was it attracted to him, or what about it?
What about it? Because he liked people so much.
Yeah.
And it was just how wonderful to have the excuse to meet all these people and talk to them.
And go everywhere around the world and make new connections and share music. He loved it.
When we met your brother at opening night, this old Bernstein night at the BSO, as I mentioned, to begin this centennial celebration here in Boston, I was trying to figure out why, as someone like me who's just a consumer of music and I don't play anything, why was Bernstein so huge? And it seems to me that there are very few people with anywhere near this talent who have combined, I was going to say highbrow and lowbrow, that's disparaging, sort of high culture and
popular culture.
I mean, that is part of the secret of Bernstein, is it not?
It is. Sure. We call it all-brow.
All-brow, yeah. Thank you. That's unibrow. What I was looking for. That's
and
great.
And it's true that he loved to break down the barriers between different genres of music, and he didn't make a value judgment between one kind of music and another. It was no small thing when he would use pop music as examples on the Young People's Concerts. He would go to the piano and sing And I Love Her by the Beatles, and all the girls would go in the audience. But it was also a kind of subliminal message to the parents who were watching that he was just as interested and full of respect for the Beatles as he was for whatever music the orchestra was playing.
And, you know, it's one of the reasons why in Boston we're so lucky to have Andras Nelson's and Keith Lockhart, obviously, which brings both worlds to the ears of people here.
We're talking to the daughters of Leonard Bernstein, Nina and Jamie. But, you know, the other thing I think, besides West Side Story, and so many of us grew up, you know, knowing the dance of the gym, we couldn't believe a guy that could write the dance of the gym with all that great jazzy music could do the New York Philharmonic, too. But also, that he was a big proponent of all these American composers that really at the top, like Aaron Copland, that didn't, you know, used to have that same sort of respect as some of the Europeans, you know what I mean?
Right, and a champion of many American composers who weren't getting their due necessarily.
Yeah.
Some of whom were writing atonal pieces, some of whom were writing aleatory pieces, and while that may not have been the style of music that our dad was composing, he had respect for it and he wanted it heard. So he went out of his way when he was in charge of the Philharmonic in those years to get that music out there and heard.
Can we end where we started for people who just tuned in? Classical.org, first year dedicated to the Bernstein experience. What's the year going to look like, Nina, starting with you? What can people expect?
Well, we have a brother, as you've mentioned,
yes.
And collectively, the three of us have been shot out of a cannon. You could say that
we're all tumbling through space.
We've been
so it's
to
been
Europe
created
and out
as
west.
The year goes along. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Well, we're traveling our heads off.
But, yeah.
We were just calculating it a little while ago, like all the places we've been between the three of us just in the past 2 weeks.
Racking up those miles.
Vienna, London, Philadelphia,
L.A. San Francisco,
Phoenix,
wow.
Tucson,
yeah. And
Chicago,
and ongoing,
and so on. And
but
on
for going. Those who can't go to all those places, I have to say, this is a one-stop.
It's great.
This site, yeah. I have
yeah,
looked
this
at
is one-stop shopping.
It is
yeah.
really
beautiful.
It's got
the interviews. It's got him talking to the orchestra. It's got the very sexy pictures. It's got the story about West Side Story by Brian McKeith. It's great. It's a wonderful job. By the way, Debbie just emailed and said, your dad used to play Scrabble in Menemsha with my great aunt and grandfather.
Oh, that is really great.
Yeah. Scrabble in Menemsha.
Yeah, can we all go to Menemsha right now and play Scrabble?
Let's go right now.
It's great to meet you both. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much.
Classical.org,
folks.
Classical.org. We're going out on Leonard Bernstein conducting the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. This is Beethoven's String Quartet number 14.
Oh, this is in his favorite.
Look at them both. Minor Opus 131. Very good. We have been speaking with Nina Bernstein Simmons and Jamie Simmons about the Bernstein. Jamie Bernstein. What did I say?
Never mind.
Okay.
I'm
you got
sorry.
It now.
Jamie Bernstein about the Bernstein Experience, which you can find at classical.org. It's a classical music entertainment experience which is celebrating the Leonard Bernstein centennial throughout the year. Jamie Bernstein's forthcoming book is Famous Father Girl, a memoir of growing up Bernstein. Nina and Jamie, thank you
Come back when the book's out, by the way. Join us again.
Congratulations on this fantastic new WGBH website.
Up next, writer
Gretchen Rubin joins us. Her book, The Happiness Project, created a movement. We'll find out what her latest book will spark. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.